From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Paying the Price, Killing the Children of Iraq, an explosive new documentary on the U.S.-led sanctions on Iraq, also Noam Chomsky on U.S. foreign policy and state terrorism. Radio stations shut down by Slobodan Milosevic in Yugoslavia. We'll talk with a leading Serbian activist. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Last week at the University of California, Berkeley's convocation ceremony, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was the keynote speaker. She was originally scheduled to speak after the top graduating student, a Palestinian woman. But word surfaced that this student intended to speak out against Albright and the sanctions in Iraq, and the university changed the order of speaking so that Albright spoke first and then left. But during her speech, hundreds of students spoke out against her, some calling her a war criminal. And all 59 people were ejected from the ceremony. There were also large demonstrations against Albright outside. We're joined right now by UC Berkeley's valedictorian, Fadia Rafidi. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, can you describe what it is that you said in your speech that Madeleine Albright did not get to hear?
I mentioned precisely what she did not say at all in her speech, which was that the United States, under her sanctioning, is imposing sanctions on the people, that is starving them to death and that is making them die of preventable illnesses, in addition to being bombed every other day by depleted uranium that's making them sick and that's making the cancer rate rise by over 70% in that region.
What did the students do who were in the audience?
Every 5 minutes, a different student group or activist group would unfurl a sign that indicted her for as being a war criminal and as telling her that she should lift the sanctions on Iraq and that she should help the situation in Colombia. And she could not give a speech that was coherent and that was uninterrupted for the whole 20 minutes that she was up there. It was a symphony of dissent.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Fadia Rafidi, and congratulations on giving your valedictory, whether the U.S. Secretary of State heard it or not. She certainly heard the dissent that surrounded it.
Thank you, Amy.
Fadia Rafidi, valedictorian of the class of UC Berkeley, class of 2000. Well, the United States and Britain bombed Iraq again yesterday. Iraq says six civilians were injured during the raids by U.S. and British warplanes. This bombing is the latest attack in what have become almost daily strikes on Iraq. Baghdad says some 300 people have been killed in the bombings, more than 800 injured since December 98. More missiles have been dropped on Iraq than during the entire war against Yugoslavia. These bombings are happening as the devastating economic sanctions led by the U.S. and Britain enter their 10th year. All of this with little, if any, coverage from the corporate media here in the United States. Well, today we're breaking through this official silence. We're going to play excerpts of an explosive new documentary by the great filmmaker John Pilger. The documentary is called Paying the Price, Killing the Children of Iraq. John Pilger has twice been voted a British Journalist of the Year. The documentary aired only on television in Britain. It's not aired here. This documentary could well be the definitive film on the sanctions and ongoing bombing of Iraq.
This film is about the punishment of a whole nation, the killing of hundreds of thousands of people, many of them young children. These are the people of Iraq, the silent victims, not only of Saddam Hussein, their dictator, but of an endless war against civilians waged by Western governments.
I have said to the people of Iraq that our quarrel was not with them, but instead with their leadership, and above all with Saddam Hussein. You, the people of Iraq, are not our enemy. We do not seek your destruction.
Our foreign policy must have an ethical dimension and must support the demands of other peoples for the democratic rights which we insist for ourselves.
Our quarrel is not with the Iraqi people. It never has been.
What the crime the Iraqi children were done to receive this punishment? What a crime.
In that sound montage, former U.S. President George Bush, British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and an Iraqi doctor.
On August the 2nd, 1990, after a dispute over shared oil fields, Iraq invaded Kuwait. 4 days later, the United Nations Security Council imposed economic sanctions, the most comprehensive in modern history. Almost everything was denied the people of Iraq, including, for the first 8 months, food and medicine. Today, 10 years later, sanctions are still in place, and the United Nations reports widespread chronic malnutrition and death among young children, an unprecedented human rights disaster. This is Dennis Halliday, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, the man in charge of the humanitarian operation in Iraq. In 1998, he resigned, accusing the West of destroying a whole society. We took him on his first trip back. In the cancer clinic of this hospital in Baghdad, he had a remarkable reunion with a young girl whose life he helped to save.
John, this is Safa Majid and her father, who is Majid Ali. Safa I met 2 years ago in this hospital when she was in very poor condition of leukemia. And one cannot deal with thousands, but one can deal with one or two or three or four children. And I was able, with the help of the World Health Organization, to bring in drugs, although be it illegally, from overseas. Enough for 2 years of treatment with this little girl. And today she looks wonderful, beautiful, and she has only now treatment once every month. So I think she's almost cured of leukemia.
She is one of four, wasn't she?
One of four.
Tell me about the others.
Well, within the first 5 weeks of meeting these four children, two died simply for lack of medications, or it was too late, in fact, to save their lives. And there were two little girls, including Safa, who have survived.
Why did they die?
They died because they had sophisticated problems, which the medications were not available.
And when you set out to help these children, you were the United Nations representative here.
That's right.
And to do it, what you're saying is you had to act illegally.
I had to breach my own economic sanctions, so to speak, established by the Security Council, as we know, led by Washington and by London. I think in this hospital we've seen today evidence of the killing that is now the responsibility of the Security Council member states, particularly, I think, Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. They should be here with us. They should see the impact of what their decisions and their sustaining of economic sanctions means. The very provisions of the Charter and the Declaration of Human Rights have been set aside. And we are waging a warfare through the United Nations on the children and people of Iraq with incredible results. Results that you do not expect to see in a war under the Geneva Conventions. We're targeting civilians, worse, we're targeting children like Safa, who of course were not born when Iraq went into Kuwait. I mean, what is this about? It's a monstrous situation for the United Nations, for the Western world, for all of us who are part of some democratic system, who are, in fact, responsible for the policies of our governments and the implementation of economic sanctions on Iraq.
When the U.S. Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, was asked on American television if she thought the death of more than 500,000 children was a price worth paying, she replied, "We think the price is worth it."
Outgoing State Department spokesperson James Rubin.
Half a million figure. So if you say that Secretary Albright said, oh, a half a million was a price worth paying. We don't accept that.
It's the World Health Organization.
I understand. Yeah. That's their figure, and it's derived by a methodology that we don't accept.
While Western politicians quibble about methodology, the latest United Nations study says that the death rate of children has doubled under sanctions. That's half a million dead in 8 years.
I want to tell you some things. What the crime the Iraqi children were done to receive this punishment?
What crime?
What a crime.
In Baghdad, what foreigners don't see are well-stocked clinics where Saddam Hussein and his rich cronies get first-class treatment, an indication that sanctions have not hurt them in the slightest.
Why should the civilian population, including children born since the Gulf War, innocent people, be held hostage to the compliance of a dictator?
I think it is a difficult problem, but you have to think of one thing. Sanctions, a sanction regime, is not a form of development aid. Sanctions are part...
Excuse me, is that... Are you serious in saying
that? I'm serious.
I would think it's the very opposite, isn't
it? Well, no, this is exactly my point. You should realize what sanctions are.
This is Peter von Welsum, who is the head of the UN Sanctions Committee, ambassador to the UN from Netherlands.
One of the coercive measures that the Security Council has at its disposal under Chapter 7. That is to say, it is part of this whole range of measures, starting from declaration to the press, resolution. Then in the end, at the very end of that scale, you will have the military action. Sanctions are the measure just short of military action. And obviously, they hurt. They are like a military measure. They're like a military action.
But who do they hurt?
This is, of course, the problem.
This is the key. This is the key point. Who they hurt.
With military action, too, you have the eternal problem of collateral damage.
You have an entire nation of those collateral damage here. Forgive me for interrupting, but let me just say this. Every UN agency dealing with health, food, agriculture, and children have reported repeatedly the tens of thousands of the most vulnerable in the society have died and are suffering as a result of sanctions. And do you seriously call that collateral damage?
No, I didn't call it collateral damage.
Well, you were drawing a comparison there.
No, I'm saying that military action has collateral damage. Sanctions are short of military action, but they also have, of course, effects that one doesn't want. And I agree with you that we have to study this further and more extensively to see how we can improve the situation without letting the regime off the hook with regard to the excessive documented interest of the government of Iraq for weapons of mass destruction.
Well, why aren't there sanctions on Israel, which has the only nuclear weapons in the Middle East?
Well, Israel is a country that has been surrounded by countries that try to wipe it out. It's not exactly the same situation.
But it has nuclear weapons.
Well, yes, but we have not yet attacked or put sanctions on every country that...
It attacks Lebanon almost every day of the week. I think these are important. Why aren't there sanctions on Turkey, which has displaced something like 3 million Kurds and caused the deaths of perhaps 30,000 Kurds? Why aren't there sanctions on Turkey?
Yeah. Well, there are many countries that do things that we are not happy with, but this is a situation which has come into being due to the invasion of Kuwait, and that is the explanation of it.
We are now in the process, through the Security Council, of destroying the human rights of the Iraqi people.
This is Dennis Halliday.
And for many of us, that is an extraordinary situation, where the chamber responsible for peace and security is neglecting the very provisions of the Charter, which forms the basis of the organization itself. It's an extraordinary phenomenon. There is no democracy in the Security Council. I think if the issue of sanctions on Iraq, after 9 long years, were to go to the General Assembly, we'd see a very large majority overturning those sanctions tomorrow.
On February the 13th, this man resigned his job. Hans von Sponeck, the senior United Nations representative in Iraq, followed his predecessor, Dennis Halliday, saying he could no longer tolerate the suffering caused by sanctions.
I do not think it is fair for such a long period of time to make a civilian population a subject to bargaining. And what we are seeing here is too often exactly that.
2 days later, the head of the World Food Program in Iraq, Jutta Burghardt, also resigned, saying she too could not tolerate what was being done to the Iraqi people. The United Nations has not known a rebellion like this.
We believe the chief humanitarian coordinator in Iraq's job is not to second-guess the Security Council's decisions about international peace and security, which is what the Security Council is charged with, making decisions about what would be more dangerous for the world. And we believe the world would be more dangerous if some of the humanitarian UN officials' views were accepted by the Security Council. They have a job there to administer a program.
I think it's a signal that somehow what I've been saying...
Former UN Secretary General, Assistant Secretary General Dennis Halliday.
For example, against the UK, is getting close to the truth. And there's an uncomfortable feeling, I think, in Washington and London that what many of us have been saying, and members of Parliament have been saying, for example, they know that we are correct. They know that the history books are going to write this thing in such a way that the Security Council, the United Nations, Washington and London both are going to be slaughtered.
Britain and America say that sanctions are aimed at the threat posed by Saddam Hussein, not at the people of Iraq. But where did Saddam Hussein come from? How did he get his weapons of mass destruction? And who gave him such power? The answers can be traced back to the discovery of the greatest of all imperial prizes, oil. In 1921, the British created yet another desert monarchy, installing a compliant king, Faisal, in Baghdad. Iraq was granted a nominal independence, with real power remaining in London, so that oil and the profits of oil continued to flow to the West. In 1958, a nationalist government swept to power in Iraq, and Washington immediately stepped in. Within 5 years, the Iraqi government was overthrown with help from the Central Intelligence Agency. It was, said the CIA, a great victory. The new regime was dominated by the Ba'ath Party, which by 1979 produced a leader the West could do business with, Saddam Hussein. He was a son of a bitch, said a CIA official. But he was our son of a bitch.
Former CIA Director Robert Gates.
I don't think there were ever any illusions about Saddam Hussein. I mean, we knew from early on that this was a man who had achieved supreme power in Iraq by personally pulling out a revolver and shooting his predecessor at a cabinet meeting. This was no Democrat, no agrarian reformer, but basically a thug, and a thug who had... good ideas about how to perpetuate himself in power, and who had significant aspirations.
Saddam has a great deal to thank the CIA for bringing the Ba'ath to power, for keeping the Ba'ath in power, for helping him personally, for providing him with financial aid during the war with Iran, for protecting him against internal coup d'etats. It's a continuing relationship from the very early 1960s until now, and it's a love-hate relationship.
Saeed Aburish, author of the book on Saddam Hussein, one of the people in the documentary, excerpts of which we have just played, paying the price, killing the children of Iraq. This a day after another of the continued bombing raids by U.S. and British planes over Iraq. Iraq says 6 people were wounded. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. This week, the situation in the West Bank erupted into what's being called the deadliest clash in the West Bank in 2 years. On Monday, 3 Palestinians were killed, at least 320 injured, when riots deteriorated into exchanges of rifle fire. 15 Israeli soldiers also were wounded. Palestinians demonstrated yesterday at Israeli checkpoints, and soldiers responded by firing tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. Palestinians say their frustration with a slow-moving peace process is fueling the unrest. We turn right now to Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He was in New York just a few weeks ago speaking to Columbia University journalism students about state terror, corporate media, and U.S. foreign policy. Noam Chomsky.
There's something called objectivity in the media. Objectivity means that you're not supposed to express your own opinions. What you're supposed to do is go to find somebody who will express those opinions and quote them. And if the person is a recognized expert, then it's fine. So, for example, and it usually works. I mean, usually in the local university, there's somebody who's a recognized expert who will say exactly the right things, so you can quote them. It's kind of interesting to see what happens when it doesn't work. So, for example, during the 1980s, for some reason, I don't understand why, the Latin American profession happens to be different from most of the academic professions. And it didn't automatically regurgitate the party line when the U.S. started a major war against Central America in the 1980s. Not because they were radical or anything like that. They somehow decided to tell the truth. So they were excluded. In fact, if you look through the 80s, interesting thing is very rarely is a Latin American specialist cited. So, for example, the major Latin America, U.S. specialist on Nicaragua, Tom Walker, who's respectably conservative and so on, he never got cited. In fact, he sent an annual op-ed to the proposal to the New York Times, never got there. In fact, the media had to invent their own specialists. And it's kind of intriguing how they did it. I'll discuss it if you like. I know something about it because some of them were friends. But they invented their own specialists who would give the party line. So anyhow, to make it clear, I'm not talking as a linguist. You know, anything that I'm saying about language, any junior high school student can understand easily, I think. And on most issues of human affairs, either nothing is known, which is the usual case, or what is known is simple enough so anybody can understand it. That's almost always true. A big effort made to prevent people from perceiving that fact, but it's basically correct. A few exceptions, but not many. Second thing I'd like to clarify has to do with manufacturing consent. I don't take any credit for that. It's not my term. The term comes from the leading figure in U.S. journalism in the 20th century, Walter Lippmann, highly respected journalist, around 80 years ago, almost. And he didn't describe manufacture of consent. He prescribed it. He said the most important duty of the intellectual classes, what he called the responsible men, namely those who follow orders, their most important duty is manufacture of consent. He called that a new device in the art of democracy, came out of his experience in Woodrow Wilson's propaganda agency during the Second World War, which was highly successful. They managed to turn a pacifist country into raving anti-German fanatics within a couple of months, and they're very impressed, especially the intellectuals. So if you read the intellectual journals, you know, John Dewey Circle and so on, the Republic, they were extremely impressed with themselves because they said for the first time in history, a war had been started not by generals and, you know, bankers and all these bad people, but by intellectuals, the responsible men of the community, who took an intelligent, careful, pragmatic look and decided that we have to be raving anti-German jingoists. What they didn't know at the time is that they were victims of an even better propaganda agency, namely the British. The British established a Ministry of Information, which was what you would imagine would be under such a title, the main purpose of which was to try to get American elite intellectuals to become raving anti-German jingoists, because that's the only way Britain would be able to survive. And it succeeded very well. And the ones who took it over were very impressed with themselves, and Walter Lippmann was one of them. He was in the committee, and he then wrote some books on what to do, and one of them explained the importance of manufacture of consent, the task of the responsible men of the community, who have to be protected from what he called the trampling and the roar of the bewildered herd, that's all those other slobs out there, while they carry out the important work of the world. It's a democracy, so look, it's a democracy, and therefore the public has a role. Their role is to be spectators, but not participants, although every once in a while they're permitted to lend their weight to one or another member of the responsible men, like what's happening next November. But then they're supposed to get back in their box. You know, that's the way a democracy functions. And to make sure it functions properly, I have to have manufacture of consent, because otherwise the bewildered herd gets out of control. So I take no credit for those views. I'm simply quoting. And it's very widely held. The US huge public relations industry is founded on exactly the same principles. In fact, its leading guru, Edward Bernays, who comes from, who was a Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy liberal, you know, highly respected left liberal, one of the main founders of the industry. He also came out of Woodrow Wilson's propaganda institution, the Committee on Public Information, it was called. And he was very impressed too, wrote a book called Propaganda a couple of years later, which is one of the manuals of the public relations industry. In which he said that our task is to regiment the minds of men just the way an army regiments their bodies. And that's good for them because he said in this period, this is the 1920s, the masses believe that they can become king, and that would be horrible because it's too stupid to understand anything. So we have to keep them off our backs, and the way we do it is by regimenting their minds, and that's the mission of honorable, respectable people. Same thing in the academic literature, a good bit of modern political science comes out of exactly the same ideas. One question that's never asked is, how come we're the responsible men? So like Lippmann doesn't ask, why am I a responsible man, but not say Eugene Debs, who happened to be in jail. In jail because he made speeches questioning the nobility of Wilson's war, so he was sent to jail. The leading figure in American labor, presidential candidate, and so on, and was treated so vindictively that Wilson wouldn't even grant him an amnesty when everybody else got an amnesty. So why is he rotting in jail, and Wilson is a respectable man, a responsible man? Okay, well, I won't bother answering the question, but that's not asked. It's not asked, so we don't have to answer it, because the answer is obvious. So that's background. One more comment. I think we should be very cautious about illusions about a golden age, as if things were somehow better once. My own impression is it's not the case. I think the media are more open and more free and more challenging of authority now than any time in any period that I've studied them, last 100 years or so. Certainly much better than 30 or 40 years ago. I don't think that's great praise, frankly, but just relatively speaking, that's happened. And I think it's partly an effect of the ferment of the 1960s, which then changed the country, you know, expanded in the 70s and the 80s, affected all the institutions, affected the media as well. I don't, it's supposed to be faint praise, but it's nevertheless, I think, If you look over the last, say, 7 or 8 years, you'll find it. Well, now, a couple of comments on the topic. I've discovered over the years when I'm asked to talk to journalists or at a journalism school that it's always a mistake to prepare. The reason is because that morning's issue of the New York Times in the lead story always gives a better topic than anything I thought I was going to talk about. So I kind of wait until the morning issue of the New York Times comes out, and I usually talk about that. And fortunately, it didn't disappoint me. I just had time before I left this morning to pick it up off the web and read it on the airplane, and it's a perfect example of what I'd like to talk about. Since these remarks will be not very laudatory, let me add another proviso. If I had to read only one journal, and if I could only read one newspaper in the world, if that's all I was able to do, I'd pick the New York Times for two reasons. One reason, you can learn a lot about what's going on in the world if you pay attention, especially to the last paragraph of a story or something. Probably more than any other paper. Secondly, you learn quite a lot about the state of mind of the privileged and powerful people in the most powerful country in the world. And that teaches you a lot about the world right away. So there's two good reasons for reading it regularly. On mornings. First lead story, which I read on the plane, and it's perfect. It's just as good an example as anything else I might have picked. So this one's by Judith Miller, who's a kind of semi-academic specialist on the Middle East and so on. It's a report on the State Department just released its annual report on terrorism, and it leaked it to the New York Times, and they're publishing it a day early. And it makes her report, that's her comment on it, makes interesting reading for itself. You can look at it. There are several countries listed as leading terrorist countries: Cuba, Iran, Iraq, Libya, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria. There are a couple of others who are listed, but not, mentioned, but not listed. One is Pakistan, and the reason it didn't make it is because Pakistan is a friendly state that is trying to tackle the problem. So therefore, it's not a terrorist state, unlike, say, Cuba. Then it goes on to explain why these are terrorist states. Incidentally, I should say that it says the problem is severe, it says some good signs, so let me mention the good signs. One of the best, they say positive sign, is the positive experiences of Spain, Turkey, and Algeria in combating terrorism. Well, the positive experiences of Spain were just illustrated a couple of days ago when several top members of the government were sent to jail for torture and terrorism in their so-called anti-terrorist campaigns. Algeria is actually an interesting case, if you want to talk about it later. But the most interesting is Turkey, because what are the positive experiences of Turkey in counterterrorism? Well, the positive experiences of Turkey are conducting some of the worst ethnic cleansing and atrocities of the 1990s. Thanks to overwhelming U.S. support pouring in from the Clinton administration, peaking in 1997 in operations that left 2 to 3 million refugees, about 3,500 villages destroyed, that's seven times Kosovo under NATO bombing, tens of thousands of people killed, every imaginable kind of torture and massacre you can think of. 80% of their arms come from the United States, increasing under Clinton. In fact, he had to evade congressional legislation because the arms shipments were mostly illegal. And that doesn't mean, pocket knives. It's jet planes, napalm, tanks. This is real mass murder. If you look over U.S. arms shipments to Turkey, it's very revealing. Also, Turkey is, of course, a U.S. military outpost and a strategic ally, so it gets plenty of arms right through the through the so-called Cold War. It stays pretty steady from about 1950 up till about 1984. In 1984, it shoots up and stays high, peaks in 1997. In fact, in the single year 1997, arms transfers to Turkey are higher than the total from 1950 to 1984. Now, what happened in 1984 was like defending ourselves from the Russians or something. No, it had nothing to do with the Russians, like most of the things attributed to the Cold War had nothing to do with the Russians or Chinese. It had to do with the fact that that's when Turkey started its counterterrorism, that is, its massive state terrorism, to suppress the Kurds in the southeast, whose protests, who were under a regime considerably harsher than the Kosovar Albanians under Milosevic prior to the NATO bombing, and whose protests were always suppressed. You can't even talk about the right of Kurds to, say, speak their own language without getting tossed in jail. And a guerrilla insurgency started, and then the counterterrorism began with the consequences I mentioned. And the arms shipments had to go up because, of course, the U.S., typically the U.S. is very much in favor of state terrorism. In fact, Washington is the center of global state terrorism and has been for years. So when a country has to suppress its own population by ethnic cleansing and massacre and village destruction and torture, you can be pretty sure that U.S. arms are going to be flowing in if it's an ally. So for example, Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, when he was just doing things like, say, gassing Kurds and torturing dissidents, he was an ally. So the U.S. was supporting him with all sorts of aid, including military aid. But Turkey's had a big insurgency, so we had to have major terrorism. And it succeeded. So by the end of 1997, the insurgency had been mostly suppressed, but not completely. Like right now, for example, at this moment, Turkish ground forces are carrying out another sweep in the southeast around the area of Tunceli, which was one of those most devastated by state terrorism. In fact, it was even called state terrorism by the Turkish government at the peak point. It's on the International Wire Service, as has been reported here. Turkish forces started April 1st. Turkish forces are also carrying out another invasion in northern Iraq. That's into a region called the no-fly zone. The U.S. Keeps bombing Iraq to protect the Kurds in that area, to protect them from the temporarily wrong oppressor. But Turkey's a fine oppressor, so when Turkey invades to carry out more anti-terrorism operations in northern Iraq in the no-fly zone, that's fine. That hasn't been reported either. But despite the fact that the operations still go on, they mostly succeeded. So Turkey's position, Turkey had been the leading recipient of U.S. arms. Israel and Egypt are in a separate category. It's nothing to do with anything except U.S. role in the Middle East. But aside from Israel and Egypt, Turkey was the champion in receiving U.S. arms because it had this major internal resistance to suppress with extreme violence. Last year, it moved down to second place. And in first place went Colombia. The reason is, and you're not supposed to notice this, because Colombia has been the leading recipient of U.S. military aid and training through the 1990s, and it has the worst human rights record in the 90s. That's a very consistent correlation, incidentally. But they have not succeeded in putting down their internal insurgency, which grows out of horrendous socioeconomic conditions and so on. They need more aid, so therefore they took first place, and next year it's going to go up. Higher even than El Salvador in the 1980s. We're supposed to believe that has to do with the drug war or something, which is ridiculous, but that's terrorism. So Turkey is praised for its positive experiences in suppressing terrorism, meaning it has carried out some of the worst state terrorism of the 90s. Like much worse than anything attributed to Milosevic in Kosovo. So everything's not bad. And so it's inconceivable that Judith Miller doesn't know this. This is the area that she specializes in. Of course, a reader of the New York Times wouldn't know it because it isn't reported. I went through Times reporting on this, and occasionally there's a mention phrase somewhere that says, things aren't beautiful. But what I just described, you'll rarely find. In fact, in the last couple of years, you'll find it in one op-ed by Middle East specialist Nicholas Pope, mentioned some of these things. So that's Turkey, where there have been good things going on. Let's look at the bad ones. As I say, Pakistan's not listed because it's a friendly ally. What about Iran and Syria? Well, they're there. I mean, ugly places, undoubtedly, and surely terrorist states. There's no doubt about Iran's involvement in terrorism. In fact, the worst example was probably inadvertent, in fact, almost certainly inadvertent. Iran was implicated in the U.S. Contra war against Nicaragua, which was a major terrorist operation. That was part of the Iran-Contra hearings. And Iran probably apparently made some inadvertent contribution to that. Some funds to Iran got shifted over there. So that's Iran's major contribution to terrorism in the last 20 or 30 years, far beyond anything else that's been attributed to them. But of course, that's not what they're talking about. What they're talking about, and they say, is that Iran and Syria have been supporting regional terrorist groups like Hezbollah, which seek to destroy the American-supported Middle East peace effort. So that's terrorist.
Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, speaking about media, state terrorism, and U.S. foreign policy. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Major news from Yugoslavia today. Serb police today took control of several media outlets critical of Slobodan Milosevic and his government. Police in woolen masks took over Studio B television and the popular independent radio B292 overnight at the station's headquarters in downtown Belgrade. Employees of the leading private newspaper and the Student Radio Index also found their offices padlocked earlier today. About 50 employees of the four main media outlets stood outside the high-rise where their offices were located after security guards in plain clothes refused to let them in. This follows the Yugoslav government announcing a major crackdown last week on the country's main opposition groups, accusing them of masterminding on behalf of NATO the slaying of a top official in President Slobodan Milosevic's ruling party. This weekend, the chair of the Socialist Party branch of Vojvodina was shot and killed, according to the government. The culprits were the anti-government student organization Otpor and the opposition Serbian Renewal Movement Party. The government says they're behind the attack and should be punished. We're joined in the studio now by Jovan Ratković, one of the founders of Otpor, which means resistance. Jovan, is your organization, Otpor, behind the slaying?
Definitely not. Otpor is a pro-democracy, non-violent movement, and all our actions so far were non-violent, peaceful, with a lot of humor and sometimes very, very funny and courageous actions, but strictly non-violent actions.
Do you know this man, Milivoj Gutovic?
No, and none of us knew him. Searching through our database, we discovered and established that he wasn't our member or activist at all.
Now, looking at the comments of others about this man, Ivan Marovic told B292 that this was pure insinuation and lies.
He said, during raids last week, the police confiscated a large amount of their political material, which could have been planted at any time. He also said that all of Yugoslavia is covered with Otpor leaflets and that probably President Slobodan Milosevic has at least five of them.
Yeah, we have a huge distribution network all over Serbia at the moment. We have our branches in more than 120 cities, towns, and even small villages around Serbia. In some of those villages, opposition parties cannot even think of getting into, and we have more than 15,000 registered activists at the moment. So yes, distribution of our material, leaflets and t-shirts is very, very good, and a lot of people would have it.
Well, regardless of whether this man who's been arrested actually did the killing or is a part of Otpor, there have been a number of arrests of Otpor activists in various Serbian towns. What are you doing about this?
Yeah, you're quite right. A couple of hundreds of our activists were arrested in the last 3 or 4 weeks all over Serbia. It's obvious that our actions, peaceful actions against the undemocratic regime, hurts that regime, and the regime is trying to prevent us from continuing with our actions. We are connected with most prominent international and Serbian human rights organizations, and we are very well connected with various independent media, both local radio, TV stations, and newspapers, and we are trying to raise awareness all over Serbia about those arrests, and general public support was great so far. So basically, because of that general public support and because of our close cooperation with independent local media, our activists are usually released after a couple of hours spent in prison.
What is Otpor? I mean, when we were covering the bombing of Yugoslavia, we did a lot of coverage of the Serbian renewal movement and the opposition groups, but I don't remember Otpor.
Otpor was founded in October 1998 by a group of 15 students of University of Belgrade. The aim was to fight for democratic changes in Serbia and to persuade all other people that democratic changes are necessary as soon as possible. Our movement was not as big as it's now, and you're quite right there. And during the NATO bombing, we were much less active than afterwards. From August 1999, immediately after the bombing started, we gained a lot of popular support all over Serbia and grew to be one of most important and biggest movements in Serbia. We are strictly a non-party movement. We have a lot of younger activists of opposition parties, but we have a lot of young people who simply want to see Milosevic out and to see democratic Serbia being established as soon as possible. And they do not care about opposition leaders. And they do not care about some other autocratic leader succeeding Milosevic. They want to see new, democratic, better Serbia, and they're fighting for that.
Jovan Ratković, what is your background?
I completed environmental sciences and diplomacy in England. I was born and raised in Belgrade. I was actively supporting student protests in 1996-97, and I always tried to organize, especially young Serbs abroad. A lot of tens of thousands of young Serbs left Serbia during last decade because of a terrible situation, both wars and obviously economic situation, bad economic situation happened. So a lot of young Serbs left the Serbia. So we tried to gather each other to help democratic movement in Serbia and one day to be able to return into the better country.
What was the effect of the NATO bombing on the opposition?
Well, basically, the effect was devastating. The image of NATO countries, especially United States and United Kingdom, who were perceived before bombing to be traditional Serbian allies from First and especially Second World War, was diminished. People are now fueled with anti-Western sentiments, even liberal intellectuals, you know, who are fighting for democracy changes. And obviously, NATO bombing established Milosevic as a strong guy again, and obviously enhanced his position, his authoritarian position.
Where does Slobodan Milosevic stand today? How strong is he?
Well, he's probably the weakest ever. The problem is that opposition parties in Serbia are still not strong enough and not united enough to get rid of him alone. They obviously need the support of various NGOs, of movements of young people like Otpor is, of independent trade unions and of independent trade media. And only the strong alliance of all of us can force out Milosevic out of office.
When the Yugoslav government said that the person that they arrested was a member of Otpor, the 53-year-old man arrested part of the student resistance movement, they said that the opposition groups, your group, as well as the Serbian Renewal Movement, was responsible for the slaying of the top official on behalf of NATO. What about your connections to, well, NATO is military, but to NATO countries? Where do you get your funding, etc.?
Well, as a movement and obviously as individuals, we were opposed to NATO bombing. We thought that the bombing could not solve problems, especially inter-ethnic problems in the Balkans. And at the beginning of the bombing, we had a couple of posters on the walls of Belgrade saying resistance to NATO as well. So our relationship with NATO is non-existent, and our relationship with NATO countries during the bombing was non-existent. After the bombing, we obviously re-established various contacts with various student groups and youth movements from all over the world, including obviously NATO countries. But we are obviously willing to cooperate with anyone who is going to help us to bring democratic changes into Serbia, and obviously to keep sovereignty of the Serbia in the process.
So you get funding from Western countries?
We get part of the funding, obviously, from various foundations and individuals, not from Western countries directly, so not from the governments of Western countries. We have a majority of our funding comes from, for example, Serbian organizations and Serbian companies in the West. So from, for example, companies of Serbian diaspora in USA. That was the main reason of my coming here in Washington, D.C. and in New York to visit our, especially young people, Serbs, who are now expatriates who live in America and who are willing to help Otpor both financially and logistically. And obviously we have some funding from wealthy middle and small enterprises from Serbia itself. And that was the way that we grew.
Now, what does it mean to say you're a student movement? You've got some retired generals, leading Serbian intellectuals, not students, who are part of Otpor. And what is your relationship to the other, to the Serbian Renewal Movement and other groups?
Well, we do not call ourselves student movement anymore, particularly because of the reasons you mentioned. Our appeal is now much wider, and we now have activists and members of very, very different age groups. But in the beginning, we were student movement, you know, present at only a couple of universities throughout Serbia. Now we have a lot of high school students, so much younger people, but a lot of much older people, a lot of pensioners, a lot of retired people, a lot of workers, you know, a lot of intellectuals. And in the last couple of weeks, Otpor became particularly trendy, you know, so we have a lot of celebrities and a lot of, you know, high rank officials of opposition parties and other NGOs joining us.
What do you mean trendy?
Well, I mean, you know, when we started Otpor was completely underground movement. The first time that the Serbian general public heard about us was when four of our activists were arrested in November 1998 for spraying graffitis against Milosevic family in central Belgrade. So it was, you know, like some sort of aura of mystery, you know, above us. Now we are very, very big movement. We grew to be much more serious. Our actions are now nationwide, and obviously our appeal to general public is now much wider.
So what is your goal right now, and how does that go together with the crackdown and the arrests of hundreds of activists?
Our goal is to first of all to help force Milosevic out of the office as soon as possible. We want to see him live peacefully, if possible, on and through fair elections, federal elections, which are due in November this year by latest. We are constantly reminding people in Serbia who is the one to be blamed for their poor standard of living, for the horrendous situation that the Serbia now is, and not now, but in last couple of years, almost last decade. And we want to make as many of undecided people, and especially first-time young voters, to go out and vote. And at the moment, we are preparing a huge campaign. The similar campaigns were done in Slovakia and Croatia. And obviously, the campaign, the shortcut for the campaign, short name is GOTV Get Out to Vote campaign. So we want to persuade people that their vote means something, that their vote can bring about the change, and that they have to use their vote, you know, and bring that change.
Do you expect a crackdown even further? Do you?
Yes. We are now probably, much stronger than regime ever expected, and quite frankly, that we ever expected, you know, to be. And I think that this accusation that we were behind the assassination of one of highest officials of Milosevic regime is, I think, just the beginning. And I think he's going to use various sorts of intimidations, arrests, crackdowns. Maybe he will even try to ban our work completely, because we are still underground organization. We are not registered officially, so he can easily try to ban us, to arrest, you know, as many activists as possible, and so on and so on. The good thing is that OTPOR is non-leader organization, so there is no official leader. There is not even official 10 or 20 leaders, you know. So he'll have to arrest hundreds and hundreds of people in order to prevent OTPOR from actions.
You talk about removing Milosevic peacefully by an election. Who are you encouraging people to vote for?
We are encouraging people to vote for the list of United Opposition Parties. Opposition parties made a mutual agreement on 10th of January not to attack each other and to fight against Milosevic together. But still, we don't think that's enough. We would like to see a unified list of election parties for a federal election. And we are currently acting as a sort of unifying force between opposition blocs.
Is there a particular person who you're putting up as a presidential candidate?
No. We are going to support, because a president of Yugoslavia is elected by Federal Assembly, not by the people directly. So people would elect only members of Federal Assembly. So we would endorse unified list of opposition parties for those.
That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, and Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Matthew Finch is our engineer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!